we've been working through the book of Nehemiah since the summer. It was hot when we started this book. It's not anymore. And as we've been going through, we've been walking with Nehemiah on this journey. We've been with him, as it were, when he was 1,000 miles away from Jerusalem, when he was off in Persia, when he was high up in the king's court and living large. And from the world standpoint, everything looked like it was going in his favor, and he was good right there. And yet he got some news. He met some travelers, his brother and some others who had come from Jerusalem. And as he was there, he asked them, "How are things?" And you remember, they say, "It's terrible. The people are living in disgrace. The walls are broken down. The gates are burned with fire. It's a rubble heap." And Nehemiah, though he is in Persia and is probably wealthy and well-to-do, is as he has the trust of the king, his heart is elsewhere. His heart is back in Jerusalem. And so when he hears this news, it wrecks him. It tears him apart. To hear that God's people are in such shambles, that God's name is, as it were, just being dragged through the mud. And so he begins this journey. He begins this process. And as we've been walking through this with him, as we've been watching Nehemiah on this journey, and as we've studied it, kind of been in there with him, there's been this continual, "And then what?" He hears this news, it wrecks him and tears him apart. "And then what?" Well, then he prays. Then he seeks God over it. He doesn't just launch right into it. He lays it out before God. "And then what?" Then God gives him an opportunity, and the king asks him what's going on, and he lays out this plan before the king, and the king says, "Yes, let's do it." That's a miracle right there. "And then what?" Then they prepare, and they get all this ready to go, and he and an entourage come to Jerusalem, and they come into Jerusalem. "And then what?" Then he looks at the walls. He sees for himself how things are going. He gathers people around and he tells them, "Look around you. You see what's going on. You see the mess that we're in. Let's do something about this. God deserves better than this." "And then what?" Then the people rise up. They say, "Yes. Yes, you're right. What we've been doing, how we've been living, the way things are going all around us, this isn't honoring to God at all. Let's do it. We're going to come. We're going to build these walls. We're going to make this city the beacon that it should be to show the world what God is like." "And then what?" The building begins. The work begins. And then comes the opposition. Then come the threats. Then come the insults. Then come all these different things from the world and even creeping inside, to where they're trying to stop this from happening, trying to stop God's plan that he has placed in the life of Nehemiah, trying to stop it from coming to fruition. "Well, then what?" Nehemiah keeps pointing the people back to the good hand of God that is upon us, to the strength of God as he has been preparing the way, and that God is going to continue this work. He is fighting for us. "Then what?" The walls are completed. The task is completed, and the people celebrate. The ones who had tried to stop it are forced to kind of step back for a bit. And this thing is done. "Then what?" Does he just go back then? No. Because he's not done yet. Because God had more in store. God is working on the people. What they saw happen in 52 days as the walls were built up and fortified and this city is beginning to look like it was before, that was all just a symbol. It was a picture for what God's doing in their life. So we see the people gathered together. We see them call for the book. "Bring out the book." We see the people being rebuilt. We see a new start happening for the people as they dive into the book, as they gather together in worship, as they celebrate God's faithfulness over the ages and God's faithfulness for them in those 52 days. "And then what?" People gather together. They see this new start. They base this thing on God's word and on worshiping Him. They come together in chapter 10 with this covenant, and they put their name to it. They publicly set their name to it and say, we are going to be about God's way, not ours anymore. We've made a mess of things. We are fathers, they're fathers. We've just made a mess of all this. We're going to go at it God's way. Then what? Chapter 11, we saw Nehemiah bringing people in, bringing some people back into Jerusalem to gather people together for the purpose of populating this vision and being able to be that beacon to the world. At the end of chapter 12, we see another festival happening as they come together and they dedicate the walls now. They've done this work, now they're going to dedicate it, and they bring the people together. They have the priests like in two different choirs, and one goes off to the right, one goes off to the left, and they come around on the walls and they're singing back and forth and dedicating the walls, dedicating the people, dedicating Jerusalem and their hearts and lives to God and service in the temple. Then what? You see, because as long as we're drawing breath, as long as you are drawing breath, God's not done with you. We like to think, I'm tired. I've done my part. I've paid my dues. I've been there. I'm just going to rest for a while. And rest is good. God put that in us. Work 6 days and on the Sabbath rest. That is important. But let's not let that rest be coasting out everything else. Because there's still a then what? See, because at the end of chapter 12, it looks like everything is hunky-dory. The walls have been built. The people have had this restart, this new start to their life built on the foundation of God. Now we come to chapter 13. As we finish off this book, and we see that in chapter 13, we kind of get this epilogue sort of deal. We'll see as we read through there that Nehemiah has been in Jerusalem and then has gone back to Persia. You know, I guess his work ticket was done, and the king said, all right, time to come back. So he'd gone back to Persia, been back there in the king's court, and makes a return trip. Because he's still thinking, and then what? You know, that was incredible. We went to Jerusalem, and even in spite of all the people coming against us, all the opposition, all the insults, the threats, everything that was coming, God did an incredible thing. And in 52 days, this enormous construction project was done to the glory of God. And we saw the people come together, and we saw them worshiping. We saw them digging into God's word. We saw them put their name to a covenant publicly and say, this is how we're going to live the way God has called us to live. And it might be tempting for him to go back to Persia and to just think back on that as, wasn't that a great time? But that's not Nehemiah. He's thinking, then what? So he comes back. So as we look at Nehemiah chapter 13 today, we're going to kind of see this final chapter of the book of Nehemiah. But this last installment of the journey that we've been taking with him, as we're called to remember. So Nehemiah chapter 13, starting in verse 1, says, on that day they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people. And in it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever enter the assembly of God. For they did not meet the people of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. Yet our God turned the curse into a blessing. As soon as the people heard the law, they separated from Israel all those of foreign descent. Now before this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, and who was related to Tobiah, prepared for Tobiah a large chamber where they had previously put the grain offering, the frankincense, the vessels, and the tithes of the grain, wine, and oil, which were given by commandment to the Levites, singers, and gatekeepers, and the contributions for the priests. While this was taking place, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went to the king. And after some time, I asked leave of the king and came to Jerusalem. And I then discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, preparing for him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. And I was very angry. And I threw all the household furniture of Tobiah out of the chamber. Then I gave orders, and they cleaned the chambers. And I brought back there the vessels of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. I also found out that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them. So that the Levites and the singers who did the work had fled each to his field. So I confronted the officials and said, "Why is the house of God forsaken?" And I gathered them together and set them in their stations. Then all Judah brought the tithe of the grain, wine, and oil into the storehouses. And I appointed as treasurers over the storehouses Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, and Padiah of the Levites. And as their assistant, Hanan the son of Zakur, son of Mataniah. For they were considered reliable. And their duty was to distribute to their brothers. Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for his service. Verse 15, in those days I saw in Judah people treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in heaps of grain and loading them on donkeys and also wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them on the day when they sold food. Tyrians also, who lived in the city, brought in fish of all kinds and goods and sold them on the Sabbath and to the people of Judah in Jerusalem itself. Then I confronted the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this evil thing you are doing, profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers act in this way? And did not our God bring all this disaster on us in this city? Now you're bringing more wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath." As soon as it began to grow dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded that the doors should be shut and gave orders that they should not be opened until after the Sabbath. And I stationed some of my servants at the gates that no load might be brought in on the Sabbath day. When the merchants and sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. But I warned them and said to them, "Why do you lodge outside the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you." From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. Then I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come and guard the gates to keep the Sabbath day holy. Remember this also in my favor, O my God, and spare me according to the greatness of your steadfast love. In those days also, I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they could not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. And I confronted them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. And I made them take an oath in the name of God, saying, "You shall not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God. And God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. Shall we then listen to you and do all this great evil and act treacherously against God by marrying foreign women?" And one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was the son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. Therefore I chased him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have desecrated the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I cleansed them from everything foreign. I established the duties of the priests and Levites, each in his work, and I provided for the wood offering at appointed times and for the first fruits. Remember me, O my God, for good. Kind of intense chapter, huh? Nehemiah's yelling at merchants. He's going to lay hands on them. Doesn't take too much to figure out what that means. And beating people and pulling hair and chasing them away. And wow, what's going on? Because this doesn't seem like one of those chapters that you read to your kids and say, okay, now this is the way we want to act when you're at school, right? So what's happening here? Well, as it starts, we kind of get a setting. On that day, they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people. And we see people understanding what they have done wrong. And then in verse 4, we get that flashback. Now, before this, Eliashib, the priest, had done these things. Let's set that scene. Because as we come and as we look, it would help us first to step back a couple chapters to chapter 10. Where the people gathered together, where the people had spent time in the Word, they'd spent time worshiping, they'd been praying and confessing their sins and the sins of their fathers before God. They'd been worshiping together and celebrating God's faithfulness through the ages, and they come together with this covenant. They put their names to this covenant, and they publicly declare, we are going to do things God's way. We're going to live His way. And as we looked through chapter 10, we saw some of the ways that they said they were going to do that. They were going to not do any business on the Sabbath, it says in verse 31 of chapter 10. That if peoples of the land bring goods or grain on the Sabbath to sell, we will not buy on the Sabbath day. We're going to keep that holy. We're going to separate ourselves and we're going to be different. It's not going to be just business as usual. Before that, verse 30 of chapter 10 said, we will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land or take their daughters for our sons. And we talked about the way the intermingling. We remember, this is not a racist thing. This is not some ethnic cleansing type deal. This has to do with not mixing with pagans. With saying, we're not going to dilute God's word by trying to mingle it into everybody else's religion and make it all just kind of this lukewarm pot of whatever. So we can't do that. Those are two things they said. They also said in verse 32, we'll take on ourselves the obligation to give yearly a third part of the shekel for the service of the house of our God. And then they go through and they talk about the grain that they'll bring and the wine that they'll bring and the sacrifices they'll bring for the house of God so that they are able to worship together. These are things that they said as they covenanted together, as they took a stand, as they put it in writing and said, this is how we're going to be defined. We're going to live God's way, not our own way. Now Nehemiah has gone back to the king. They said in the 32nd year, so he'd spent about 12 years there in Jerusalem before he went back. And then after a time, it said he took leave from the king to come back and check it out, because Nehemiah is there and thinking, and then what? What's happening now in Jerusalem? As the people have had a restart, as they've come together, as they're chasing God's dream for themselves, what's it look like? And so he comes back, and the first thing that he said was that Eliashib the priest, the one who was taking the responsibility to lead the people in worship, to gather the people together, to make sacrifices, to point them to God and His goodness and His faithfulness. He, being related to a certain Tobiah, had gone into the temple area, had gone into this chamber that was holding all these things for worship and cleaned all that stuff out of the way so that Tobiah could have a nice big chamber to stay in. All right, those of you that have been with me through this book for a while, do you remember the name Tobiah? We saw it in chapter 2, where Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite and Geshem the Arab were all coming up against Nehemiah and the work that was being done. We saw him again in chapter 4 when they're sending threats and insults against the people of Israel. We saw it again in chapter 6. As the wall is being completed, and Tobiah, they say, is specifically not very happy about this and is still kind of sending letters into Jerusalem to subvert what's happening there. Tobiah has been one of these guys spearheading the destruction of Jerusalem. And yet here we have the priest, one of them who is responsible to turn the people's eyes to God, who's bringing him in. And I don't think it is probably a diabolical choice to ruin everything on Elisha's part? I think it probably has more to do with, well, I know him. And from a worldly standpoint, he's got some power and he's got some influence, and maybe this can be an okay thing. Because that can sometimes be one of the temptations for us, to gravitate around those who have pull, who look like they have strength from this world's perspective. And Eliashib, who is supposed to be turning people's eyes to God, is maybe looking to his relations too much and looking to who looks like has power too much and inviting him in. And so Nehemiah, when he hears about this, he says, no, we're not going to have any of that. Right? What does he do? It says in verse 9 that he gave orders, he cleansed the chambers and brought back the vessels of the house of God. He went in and gathered up all, got his bed and his dresser and all of Tobiah's stuff, and he chucked it out the window. That stuff's got to go. That guy's got to get out of here. Because we need this space to turn people's eyes back to God, the true Almighty One. We also see in verse 10 that the people had kind of stopped giving portions to the Levites. They'd stopped supporting the work of worship in the time. And that the Levites had gone back to farming just to make things right. And Nehemiah comes in again and he says, no, this can't be. We said that when we started this thing, we're going to be based on what God is doing. That this restart was all based on worshiping God and focusing on Him. And out of that, out of the worship of God and with our eyes focused on Him, overflow is everything else. The way we treat others has to do with the way we are interacting with God. The way we do business has to do with the way we interact with God. The way we raise our families has to do with the way we interact with God. Everything else is an overflow. And so Nehemiah comes in and he sets that stuff straight. And he brings in people that are going to be reliable to submit to God. Down to verse 15, we see it continuing that there are those who are tramping out wine presses on the Sabbath. They're doing business on the Sabbath. And things have just kind of gone back to business as usual. It's just another day. And another day means there's work to be done and there's money to be made. And so these people are taking full advantage of every day they have without this idea that God has called them to separate and to be have a day where they just are with Him. And finally, we see where the people that made the covenant said, we're not going to do any business on the Sabbath. Check. We're going to give. We're going to take it all on ourselves to give to the Levites and the priests and to make sure that's done. Oh, missed that one too. They started off with, we're not going to mix with the pagans around us. And Nehemiah says that when he comes back in those days, he saw the Jews had married women of Ashdod and Ammon and Moab. And to make sure we get this idea that it wasn't just about they're different than me, and they're a different race or whatever. And we can look back at Israel's history. A few years ago, we looked at the book of Ruth. Remember, Ruth was a Moabite. Ruth was one of these cursed people that is never supposed to enter into the congregation. And yet Ruth, as she follows her mother-in-law, says, where you go, I'll go. Where you die, I will die. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. See, Ruth, even though she was born a Moab, she said, I'm with you. I'm following the one true God. And so as they've been marrying, it says, women of Ashdod and Ammon and Moab, the trouble is they still identify with all those other pagan religions. But it says their children don't even speak the language anymore. They know nothing of what God is doing, because as we start trying to take worship of God and sort of mix it in with other things, maybe dilute it down just a little bit so that we can get along, that's not God we're worshiping anymore. And it just goes by the wayside. And that's what happened. Because in all things, vision is something we've been talking about throughout Nehemiah. And vision, the leadership books will say, vision leaks. Vision leaks. We get this idea, we get this great thing, but then it just kind of leaks away. And that's what happened to the people, I'm afraid. They get this great idea. We're going to follow God. We're going to be different from the people around us. We're going to be a light to them, to show them what God is like. But without diligently following God, without submitting to God, without renewing that vision again and again, they just slide back into the same old ways. Slide back into the ways of just, you know, trying to mix in God with the people around us. Tone him back a little bit so it's not so offensive, and we'll just all get along. And the vision leaks away. And they don't even recognize themselves anymore. Or working on the Sabbath, just saying, well, you know, the other people are doing it, it's not that bad. And I'll pray about it as I'm doing it, and not really thinking about it before too long it leaks away and they don't recognize themselves anymore. Whether it's a vision for a ministry, we've been asking that question. What does God burn in your heart? What is that thing that you look at and you say, this is not the way it should be. Things need to be different. And that drives you. Or is it a way that you say, there could be so much more here. God has so much in store and we need to chase after what he's doing here. Maybe that's the way he's calling you. But without renewing that vision, without keeping that in front of us, it leaks away. That vision might be more personal. It might just be, this is what I want our family to look like. This is the way we should be interacting as family, the way husband and wife are interacting one with the other, the way we interact with our kids, the way our kids interact with each other. This is what I want for our family. But if we don't think about that, if we get into what is so easy to do, just trying to survive one day to the next, and never had that vision before us, it leaks away. And pretty soon we don't recognize where we were. It might even be just you personally in your own life, your own sanctification, your own walk of holiness as God is walking and with you and calling you to do things. And you think, this is where I'm going. This is what I want to be. But in the day-to-day, as things get going and we don't keep that in our minds, then those little decisions start to look like little decisions. Those little temptations start to look like, it's, you know, the big stuff we'll watch out for, but the little ones, that's okay. And we don't recognize them as battles. And the vision leaks. Nehemiah from back in Persia again is saying, and then what? He wants to go and see. The people in Jerusalem had not been thinking, and then what? They've been thinking, that was great, and now we'll just coast on it. Brothers and sisters, we need to be continuing to ask that question. God, then what? What's next? And have that before us. Again and again, as Nehemiah is walking through this, he prays that prayer, remember me, O God. We see that as he's looking at this, as he has these harsh reactions to people, it's not about making his name great. It's not about, I worked really hard here, and my name is on this, and you're going to do it. It's about, we're here to be God's beacon. And he's looking to God and calling the people to remember God, even as he's asking God to remember him. And so as we close this book of Nehemiah, as we look at even the subtle warning there in that last chapter, let's never kid ourselves that we've arrived. Let's never fall for that deception that now we're good and we don't have to think about anything anymore. Because there's always then what? Our God, we thank you. We thank you for your goodness. We thank you for your patience, your faithfulness. I thank you, God, because I know that time and time again in my own life, I've forgotten vision. I've not had it before me and been diligent at looking at where you are calling me. And Lord, when we coast in the wrong direction. And before long, we don't even recognize it. And so, God, I pray that you will continue to burn in our hearts a passion for what you are doing. That you will continue to grow within us this hunger to know you more. To follow you, to chase after you. To that next unknown, then what, God? Pray this in Jesus' name.